We're about to have a conversation with David Kennedy. You've heard his name. The idea of Operation Ceasefire has been in most of our publications in Maryland. You've heard it on TV news. You've heard it on the radio. An idea to stem the violence in Baltimore and go after the worst actors, but involving community as well as the institutional partners, the mayor's office, the police department, and the rest. This has worked across the country in stemming violence. People still have many questions about it, but we thought what was really important to hear the voice of David Kennedy, what his theories are, how it's worked across the country, and what he has to say in a very non-confrontational interview so you can get a sense of what's going on. David Kennedy, of course, is director of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice Center for Crime Prevention and Control. This began as Operation Ceasefire in Boston, Massachusetts in the 90s when they had this huge surge of murders among young people. It went down to literally zero and then brought it to High Point, North Carolina there, and where it worked successfully and then has spread across the country to Detroit, Chicago, Oakland, and more. He's the author of Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and The End of Violence in Inner City America. Here's our conversation with David Kennedy. So, David, let me just say, first of all, welcome back to Baltimore. It's good to have you back with us here.
We're really, really excited about this. Thank you.
So, I'm curious. We're not going to rehash old territory, but I'm curious about why you decided to come back.
Oh, we've always been ready to, as it were, come back, and I've never lost my connection with the city entirely. I made some very, very strong friends and created some very strong colleagues. This is almost 15 years ago now, and I've been in regular touch with a lot of them the entire time. And the basic outlines of the approach that we've been developing this entire time, things have developed and changed a lot since the sort of first Baltimore round. But different aspects of that approach have been used by the police department and the U.S. Attorney's Office and probation and parole. And so it's absolutely not a blank slate.
So let me take a step backwards here again. I mean, because I think for a lot of our listeners who maybe have seen your name in the Sun or some other place, but really are not familiar with Operation Ceasefire, we talked a lot about what's been going on in Chicago with this Operation Stumble in Baltimore with former felons coming in and really working to stem violence in communities. But and I think that's also called Operation Ceasefire in Chicago.
Not anymore, actually, and this is useful because the terminology got hopelessly confusing for people.
Uh-huh.
So what you're talking about with standalone, often ex-offender street outreach workers,
yes,
is what the Chicago team that has been promoting that now calls Cure Violence. They have dropped the Ceasefire name. And what you and I call Operation Ceasefire is something different, but which also often includes street outreach workers as very close partners.
So let's kind of describe for our listeners, David, I mean, A, what you started many years back in the 90s and what you're doing now. I mean, I'm going to get to give the theoretical and practical framework for what is coming to Baltimore so people
yep.
really understand it.
Yep. So this is actually surprisingly straightforward. It's a huge amount of work, and the implementation challenges are very real. This is not easy in practice, but in outline, it's actually remarkably straightforward. So this is aimed at homicide and really serious violence. And in Baltimore and everywhere, cities just don't change. They're not different in the core ways that I'm about to describe. In Baltimore and everywhere else, homicide and that kind of really extreme violence is driven by a very, very small, very special street population. It's a population of groups, and whatever language one wants to use, the language doesn't really matter. They are gangs, they are sets, they are posses, they are drug crews, but they are groups of very high-rate offenders. There are not very many of them in any city. So there, if you look across an entire city and look for these groups, all of them added up together will consistently come in at under 0.5% of the city's population, and they will be connected with 60 to 75% of all homicide in the entire city. So it is a tremendously concentrated problem. Of that 0.5%, it's maybe 1 or 2 in 10 that we call impact players, the shooters, the instigators, the guys who really make things happen. And so when you get down to that level, it is a very small population. So what Ceasefire does is put together a city partnership of every conceivable law enforcement agency, community figures, and social service providers. And it, in various ways, directly communicates to those groups. So you can call in individual members who are on probation and parole and talk to them and tell them to go back and tell the group that they run with. You can go find the impact players in the community and talk to them directly. But in various ways, you begin and continue to communicate to these groups. And what the partnership says is the following things. It says, we know who you are. We know what you are doing. We want you alive and out of prison. Even law enforcement, whatever you may think of them, would rather see you have a successful life than have to tell your mother you're dead or have to lock you up. Your community absolutely rejects the violence and cares about you, but absolutely needs you to stop. And this is not a negotiation. We will offer you all kinds of help. We would like you to take what we have to offer you. Remedial education, emergency assistance, job training, job placement, therapy for your trauma. We'll do everything we can for you. But the violence is going to stop. And what you need to understand going forward is that when somebody in your group kills somebody, we will no longer stop with investigating and trying to prosecute that killing. We will look at all the crimes anybody in the group may be committing. And while we try to prosecute the homicide, the price to the group for the shooting may be, for example, that we move the undercover drug squad in and everybody in the group gets arrested for street drug sales. And if your group wants that kind of attention, then allow somebody in the group to kill somebody and we will arrange it. So it's these sort of four basic things. It is this surgical focus on the very small, very special street population that drives the violence. It is the communication of an unflinching community standard that the violence is not okay. It's the offer of help and support to those who want it, and it is the prior communication of a very meaningful group-level sanction for what is, in fact, group violence. And it consistently produces quite meaningful, usually quite rapid impact on the streets.
So one of the things here that is, I guess, as it is in most cities in America that I know of, that I've visited and been through, there's a huge trust gap, distrust, between the community. Many people in the community, even the ones who want people who are just abhor the violence and are trying to live a decent life, as most people are in poor communities, but a huge distrust between them and the police and the authorities because of the violence that takes place between them, because of all the number of reasons that we can articulate. So,
yep.
How do you bridge that in this
process? So this is one of the several important ways that this work has really developed enormously since Baltimore looked at this the last time 15 years ago.
Yeah, right.
So you are exactly right. The cold fact is that one doesn't find this level of serious violence except in historically troubled minority communities with broken relationships with the police. And that relationship is broken in both directions. The community thinks ill of the police, and many in law enforcement think ill of the community.
Right.
And it is vitally important to address that. And what's remarkable about this conversation is that what I just said, that this has to be fixed, is now essentially conventional wisdom in law enforcement. People think of the cops as Neanderthals a lot of the time. And in fact, the current crop of law enforcement leadership in the country is extraordinarily open and progressive on this point. And they understand, so I'm not speaking for any law enforcement figures in Baltimore right now. I'm talking about the kind of national movement on this. The Baltimore figures will make up their own mind and move in their own way on this. But it is no longer at all unusual to see these top figures doing what, for example, Superintendent Gary McCarthy in Chicago has done, which is go to these angry communities and say in very plain language, I get it. People wearing this uniform were actually part of a formal racist conspiracy against your community until 1968, when the civil rights laws finally caught up with our core American values. And since then, people wearing this uniform have treated you with disrespect. They have not done what we all want, which is to keep you safe. We have done things like arresting huge numbers of your men, which have done unintentional damage to your community. We didn't mean to do that damage. We are not currently part of a racist conspiracy, but we certainly accept that when we arrest all the men in the neighborhood, that hurts them and their families and the larger community. And we absolutely want to do something different. And one of the concrete ways in which we can do something different is to stop treating everybody in the neighborhood like a potential violent felon and really focus in on the very small number of people who are even at high risk for being violent. And we want to deal with them so that you can talk to them, we can offer them help, we can give them prior notice about how law enforcement is going to be done. And will you work with us on that? And communities really welcome that.
So when you say things have changed a lot in the last 15 years since you started this process, Boston and other places, I have some questions about Boston I want to come back to. But so this is part of it. But what have you learned that's different? What have you learned from, there were a lot of people who in Baltimore and other places kind of had a real serious critique of ceasefire, it wasn't strong enough, it couldn't do the job, and there's all kinds of things we can get into. But tell me what you've learned over these last 15 years that has altered some of the ways that people may be approaching this issue.
Well, there was a long stretch in the work in which people would really rather debate whether they thought it would work rather than try it seriously and see if it worked. And we're well beyond that now. So I'm going to talk about ways in which the theory and the practice have really evolved. But for this conversation, probably the most important thing that we've learned is that, yes, it will work in environments like Baltimore's. That's just not open to debate any longer.
Mm-hmm.
For the longest time, no matter where it worked, people would say, well, that's not Chicago. And this is now what's driving the historic crime declines in Chicago, and we know it works in Chicago.
Which is a much bigger place.
It's been done in L.A., right. It's been done in Oakland, it's working in New Orleans. So that debate is done.
Mm-hmm.
And that really focuses the mind wonderfully. It is a fact that when we were trying to do this in Baltimore the last time, nobody knew for sure whether it would be effective in that very intense environment. Fortunately, we're beyond that now. I think there are three or four fundamental ways in which the work has really evolved. So one is pretty closely connected to what we were just talking about, which is that we know a great deal more now about how, in just absolute nuts and bolts terms, how to organize and manage and direct it, and what the information system should look like, and how you get the interagency accountability relationships right, and what project management needs to look like, and all those basic institutionalization and sustainability issues. At sort of a more theoretical level, we have learned a great deal about the power of the community element to carry a lot of the weight that we normally think law enforcement has to carry. Good communities are safe and healthy not because there's a cop on every corner and everybody's afraid of going to federal prison. They're healthy because the normal norms and standards of the community say there are things that we do and things that we do not do in this community. And in particular, you know, shooting people and standing in public and selling drugs to strangers are things we don't do here. And there are many, 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 many more people in every community that feel like that than feel the other way. And as a practical matter, we've learned an enormous amount about focusing the norms and standards of the majority in any community, no matter how troubled, on the small number of people who feel and behave otherwise. And the better what we call the moral voice of the community works, the less need there is for law enforcement. And that's what everybody wants. That's really tightly linked to what we were talking about a moment ago, which is this broken, very deeply racialized schism between many of these communities and especially the police. And that is, as we've touched on, something that in fact can be addressed in a very meaningful way in relatively short order. And it has two pieces. So one is the anger the community feels at the history and present behavior of law enforcement is very real, and it needs to be addressed. The other side is the simple fact that no community can have standards set for it from the outside. And if in its historical and present anger at law enforcement, the community is not saying clearly in its own voice, you know, no matter how angry we are at the police, we don't shoot people here. That's not okay. And if the relatively small number of people who are thinking about shooting somebody don't get that, then neither the police nor anybody else can fix that from the outside. So we've come to understand very, very, very clearly that any effective work in this area means that both law enforcement and communities need to shift their behavior. It's not the usual business of one side looking at the other and saying, you know, you change. Everybody's got bad history here and everybody needs to move. And just to say it again, that's not as hard as people think it is.
So we're here talking right now with David Kennedy. David Kennedy, of course, is director of the John Jay Criminal Justice Center for Prevention and Control. He developed Operation Ceasefire Group of Violence Intervention, in Boston, Massachusetts, in the 90s, in the High Point Model in North Carolina. Author of Don't Shoot One Man, A Street Fellowship, and end violence and the end of violence in inner city America, bringing back to Baltimore the Operation Ceasefire. We're going to talk very concretely about how this works right after this break. Welcome back. We're here with David Kennedy, who is bringing, as I said earlier, Operation Ceasefire back to Baltimore. And we're going to talk very concretely about how this is going to work in our community. And I wonder what you see the elements. One of the things that was in the paper, and maybe this is not a major factor, maybe it is, was that there was no clear indication that the State Office of Parole and Probation would cooperate. I think there's some very clear the police in Baltimore are cooperating, that the state's attorney's office is cooperating, that Operation Safe Streets will be a deep part of this in terms of doing the community organizing work and getting out there, because they've been doing an amazing job on the east side of Baltimore now, you know, stopping the violence. But is that going to be a problem?
The problem is the lovely tendency of the Baltimore press to cause trouble. There is not only no bonfire, there's not even tinder or a spark yet. To my knowledge, and this may be wrong, mm-hmm. because I'm not driving this in Baltimore. The Baltimore partners are, and I will be working with them. So I am not even privy to every single conversation that's gone on so far. To my knowledge, there hasn't been even any formal outreach to probation and parole. There may have been, but if there has been, I'm not aware of it. And I have absolutely no reason to think that when the time comes and all those approaches are made correctly, that there won't be willing cooperation.
When people, some of the people I've seen critique it, and I've heard people over the last week or so say that, well, look, in Boston, the murders went down, but then you see all the stats, they went back up again. So this can only work for a short while because there's no way to keep this consistent and growing over a long period of time, that it just dissipates after a bit. But so what's the response in terms of what people are saying about the fluctuation in murder rates among the young people in Boston?
Boston hasn't done this properly since 2000.
Why is that?
Because they kicked it to the curb for internal reasons and never really put it back together.
Uh-huh.
And you and I have talked about this before. The language that grew up around Operation Ceasefire when it was first invented and put in place in Boston was that it was the Boston miracle.
Right, right.
And unfortunately, Boston has treated it like a miracle, which is something somebody else does. And as potent as this stuff is, it's not magic. And if you don't do it, it won't work. So there's a very long record now in many, many cities nationally of the approach having been put in place, being very effective. People take their eye off the ball. It dissipates. And this is not a cure. It's more like a vaccination. And the violence comes back. And again, in a lot of cities that have done this, there is a relentless impulse to look back and refight those old wars rather than to get back to business. And what's in fact happening nationally, this approach, this work is now nearly 20 years old.
Right.
And people who have seen it develop, many people in leadership positions now have grown up with it. This is not radical insurgent stuff anymore. This is really mainstream work these days. And that means now that people take it seriously. They understand that if it's somebody's pet project, if it's a pilot, if it's grant funded, all those things go away. And where it's being done properly now, it's being done properly in a lot of places. It is simply being built into the standard operating procedures of the city and the relevant agencies and partners. And we have a number of cities now where it's very, very, very clear that you can keep it going. It actually seems to work better over time. but it's real work, and you've got to do it.
I mean, one of the things that might pretend to be really positive is that the police superintendent, Gary McCarthy, in Chicago, who you've been working very closely with, is very close, and they visit often with Baltimore City's police commissioner, who was recently hired.
That's right.
They seem to be on the same page on a lot of levels.
You know, look, this work right now has been implemented or is being implemented in Newark, Chicago, New Orleans, Los Angeles, Detroit, three cities across Connecticut, Oakland, California, on and on. These are all very demanding cities with top flight police chiefs. This is really the cream of the crop of the current police leadership, and they all believe in this stuff. Right? Just what I was touching on a moment ago. This isn't some radical side idea anymore. It has the track record. People believe in it. They know how to do it. They're building it into the same kind of information systems and Comstat and all that sort of thing that they use to drive other law enforcement approaches. It's got very high-level Department of Justice support. They're funding innovations and site work. So we know how to do this stuff.
One of the things that a couple of things I really want to talk about here, one is just literally how this happens. I mean, we're talking about a system. Let me see if I have this right, and you can correct me. But what I understand from all I've read that you've written and conversations you and I have had in the past, and what I've heard from people in Chicago and Oakland is that these parts of our state, city government, come together, police, health department, other parts of the government come together with community who actually know who are the bad actors in the community, bring them into, let's say, a community center and sit down and have this conversation. We know who you are. Is that where it begins, literally?
Yeah, pretty much. So, again, in outline, it's just not that complicated.
Uh-huh.
So if you start with the problem on the ground, which is what we always do, we don't start with system reform or big partnerships or huge open meetings. You start with the streets. And the violence on the streets is driven by very, very special groups of very high-rate offenders. They mostly hurt one another. The single group that benefits the most from this is the street guys. You're keeping them alive more than anything else. So you identify the groups. That's easy. Frontline law enforcement knows these groups, will know many of the people in them. If you look at the groups, the guys in them are such active offenders that every group on nearly every day is going to have at least one person on probation and parole.
Right.
So that means you can work with the probation and parole authorities to command their attendance at what we call a call-in, one of these meetings. And as a condition of their court supervision, they have to show up. So they walk in and they see, you know, something on the order of some dozens of members of the partnership. So there will be representatives from the police department, probation, parole, the state attorney's office, the U.S. attorney's office, DEA, FBI, ATF, you know, animal control, everybody. There will be people that they respect because of their roles in the community, and those are folks like surviving mothers of murdered children, older, wiser gang members, the right kind of community faith leaders, those sorts of folks. And there are people who can provide a wide range of social services and other kinds of help. And that partnership looks at them and it says, you're going to go home. This is not a sting. This is not a trick. We need to talk to you for about an hour. Go home and You know, when you're free to go an hour from now, go back and tell the guys you run with what you are about to hear. So the call-in is a way of using the probationers and parolees to communicate back to their larger groups. And then the partnership says, we care about you. We want you alive. We want you out of prison. We want to help you. The pain that the violence is causing in the community is unbearable, and we need it to stop. You can change, and there are people here just like you who did change, and they will tell you that if they did it, there's no reason you can't. We would like to help you do that. And as far as the violence is concerned, this is not a negotiation, and we're not asking. And the law enforcement practice around the violence has changed. And we respect you. We want you to understand that. We think you will make good, informed decisions if we tell you what you need to know. And when you walk out of here, we will be paying systematic attention to the groups that kill people.
So I've heard there are people who say, look, this is not addressing the root causes of the crime, poverty, dislocation, people not being able to have access to work, people working for less than minimum wage, housing conditions. And clearly you're not saying that any of this is addressing that. You're saying, it seems to me in some ways, you're saying, maybe I'm not going to put words in your mouth, David, but you know, if you can address the violence in the poorest communities, at least stop it, the other issues might be able to be addressed even better.
That's exactly right. So I think of the work we do as the kind of community equivalent of shock trauma care. If your brother's been shot, then we need to stabilize him and save his life before we can worry about his, you know, education and job placement. And the communities I'm committed to are in crisis, and they cannot make any headway on economic development and education and all the rest of the things that we care about so deeply when people are afraid to go outside. So this is about that. But the other thing that we understand better and better and better and better about the violence is that it is driven far more by the street code, the idea that, again, this small number of men live and die by, that if they're disrespected, they have to hurt somebody. It is the respect culture that drives the violence more than anything else. It's driven by their objective risk. The national homicide rate now is between 4 and 5 per 100,000. It's been coming down steadily for decades now, as people know. If you are in this core street population, your homicide victimization risk can be as high as 3,000 per 100,000 every year. And you get any one of these guys alone and ask him why he is carrying a gun, and he will tell you that there are people out there who are trying to hurt him. And objectively, he's right. So this nearly unbelievably dangerous street environment has a life of its own. It is a positive feedback cycle. It feeds on itself. And the violence is driven by what we keep coming back to, which is the broken relationship between the streets and law enforcement. If you know who's killed your friend, and you don't feel like you have recourse to go to the police, then you take care of it yourself. And all of those factors, the respect culture, the objective dangerousness, the trauma these guys experience, and the idea that the police won't help you and you can't go to them, those are actually much more powerful drivers of the violence than unemployment is.
I mean, one of the things that I think that's really important here is, and I think I've read that you've said this before, is that like heroin, like cocaine, like anything, the street corner itself, the street culture, the street life is as much of an addiction as anything. This is like breaking the addiction of the corner.
That's exactly right. We've actually been focusing on this very, very strongly over the last year or so. We've been working to try to figure out how to do a much better job on what we have traditionally called the social services element of the whole approach. And a lot of our work in this area has been driven by the wisdom of some extremely seasoned and gifted people nationally whose day-to-day work is as street outreach and other kinds of very close engagement with the streets. And what they will say is especially two things. They will say that these group members are married to their enemies. And what they mean by that is even if I decide I'm done and I want out, then there is somebody out there who doesn't care about that because his group has beef with my group. I put my guns down. All I do is make myself more vulnerable to him. And the street culture has a way of not letting people go even when they want to. And so you can address both sides of that relationship and really need to if it's going to be effective for either side. And that, you know, as corrosive and destructive and ultimately hollow as street culture is, it is romantic, it's high voltage, it is seductive. And if you're running with people who tell you every day that they are your family and we have thug love and we will take bullets for each other, then some social worker sitting across from you and saying, I'll do a needs assessment and do an intake interview and then we'll do case management and I'll give you referrals, has no juice whatsoever. And what people leaving the streets really need is a new set of relationships, something much more like a recovery community than a jobs program that can begin to replace those relationships with healthier ones.
You know, I was thinking that about this. You know, we had this. We've seen a rise in heroin use and even some ODs among white suburban kids, and from parts that are at least 10 miles north of Baltimore City, and some closer. But I'm saying that because the heroin use, the drug dealing, and whether it's marijuana or heroin or whatever the substance is as big in suburban areas as it is in inner cities. But nobody gets busted in suburban areas because everything's indoors, done
right.
Quietly.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? In this kind of in their close quarters between cars and whatever. And that, I mean, that's a primary difference. And so, of course, who gets targeted are young black men and young black people in the street because they're easy pickings.
Well, I'm going to say that that does some disservice to law enforcement.
What do you mean?
Look, law enforcement cares more about violence than anything else, as law enforcement should. And where there are high levels of violence, there is a nearly inexorable connection to street-level drug activity and other aspects of the illicit economy. And when law enforcement goes to neighborhoods that are really violent and tries to do something about it, it casts a wide net and sees the connection, of course, between the drug activity and the guns and the violence. And there are going to be a lot of there's going to be a lot of activity in those areas. But saying that the police are going there because it's easy pickings is really unfair. They're going there because they're trying to save people's lives, and they've been doing the best that they can. If the violence level in those white suburbs was as high as it is in the inner city, then they would be getting a lot of the same kind of attention, but it isn't. And what that tells us, and again, this has become absolutely mainstream in law enforcement, is that the drugs are not the violence problem. There are lots of different kinds of drug markets, and many of them are not violent at all. The issue is the violence, and the mistake that a lot of cities have made for a very long time is saying it's all the same thing, and we're going to deal with the violence by relentlessly hitting the drug activity. It doesn't work. It scoops huge numbers of especially black men into the criminal justice system. Whole neighborhoods get treated like everybody in them is a felon. They hate it. They don't trust the police anymore. It drives to stop snitching, all that kind of thing. And Gary McCarthy, whose name keeps coming up, the superintendent in Chicago, will say at every opportunity in public, I love this quote, he says, "I'm done chasing the kilo fairy." And what he means by that is he's come to the belief that drug use is a public health issue. Drug violence is a police issue. And that is a very important distinction.
So when does this begin in Baltimore?
I will leave that to the city partners to speak to.
So is this going to, you think, will it begin as something, as people usually do, a pilot program in a small, in a community? Do you think it's going to be broader?
Again, I should let them make those announcements.
And them would be who? The mayor's office?
And Chief Batts and that core team, yeah.
And is there a sense from your conversations with people in the city when this begins? I mean, when this whole effort is really going to kind of hit the ground?
I'll just keep saying it. They should speak to those issues.
Okay. I mean, so what will your role be here then? Can you speak to that?
So I'm now at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City.
Right.
And with my college president, Jeremy Travis, this is a major focus for the college. And we launched something we call the National Network for Safe Communities several years back. And it is a national network of people devoted to this work. And it's large, it's growing. It involves people in law enforcement, people in corrections, community figures, social service providers, academics. There's a large, large, large body of very committed people carrying this work forward now. And what we do is we support sites directly. So we will be working one-on-one with Baltimore to get this up and running and keep it going. Increasingly, because of the scale of the national work, a lot of what we do is connect cities with other cities and peers with peers. So community people in Baltimore with community people in Detroit, narcotics investigators in Baltimore with narcotics investigators in Philadelphia. There's a very rapid pace of innovation within the core framework. And there's a very, very high level of enthusiasm and commitment. So we're brokering those relationships and kind of information expertise exchange more and more.
Well, David Kennedy, I appreciate you taking all this time with our listeners here and to the people of Baltimore in this conversation. Look forward to talking to you a great deal more in the coming years as we see this unfold in our community.
Just to end where we began, thank you, and we are really, really pleased and excited about all this.
So we've been talking with David Kennedy, who is the director of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice Center for Crime Prevention and Control. He developed Operation Ceasefire, dealing with group violence intervention in Boston and cities across the country that has proven highly successful in lowering the violence and murder rate in many inner-city communities and the arrest rate as well. He's the author of Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and The End of Violence in the Inner City. We said earlier, when David Kennedy first tried to do this in Baltimore, it started under Kurt Schmoke's administration and then was shot down by then-Mayor Martin O'Malley, who's now our governor. We'll see how this works. The people may agree or disagree with what you've heard today on this conversation, but let me just say that it is coming to Baltimore. It's going to involve many people. We'll have continuing conversations about this and have a chance for a real intimate dialogue with all of you about this, your questions, concerns, and your hopes for it as well, whatever that may be. So this is our conversation with David Kennedy. We needed to have it because Operation Ceasefire is coming here. He's the man who's created it.